psychological warfare organization in the occupation army, whose goal is to weaken the Palestinian front so as to make it appear as if there's a division within the resistance to affect our people, or to make us comment and say that unity exists, or that there is a certain thing going on which may lead to providing information to the Zionist entity that will help it reach the leadership of the resistance in Gaza. We say that the leadership decisions are made through the contribution of all members without exception. Its decision enjoy the support of all leaders of the movements in their various positions. Rather, I go further and say that we do not take these decisions, especially regarding the ceasefire, except after consulting with our brothers in the Islamic Jihad movement and in the other resistance factions, because they are also partners in sacrifice. They are our blood partners. We cannot take a decision without consulting them all.
Thank you so much, Dr. Osama Hamdan, member of the political bureau of Hamas Resistance Movement. Goodbye.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Almost 400 schools in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed during the Zionist regime's genocidal war. These schools previously served approximately 460,000 children and 17,000 teachers. According to United Nations estimates, at least 55% of schools will require either major repairs or complete reconstruction. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Khaled is a baby, born shortly before the Zionist regime declared its genocidal war on Gaza. He has spent most of his life in very unhealthy conditions. In the early stages of the war, his family had to evacuate their home in northern Gaza. Sahar, Khaled's mother, said, We had to walk on streets filled with rubble. We were under constant bombardment. It was absolutely terrifying. Khaled's parents are unable to provide him with bare necessities. Diapers are scarce, so are infant formula and other food items. Sahar said, He doesn't even have enough winter clothes or blankets to cover him during the cold nights. Khulud, a relative of Sahar, has a one-year-old son. Displaced and malnourished, Khulud is not able to produce sufficient breast milk for her child. Her son requires special diapers, as otherwise his skin becomes irritated. Finding them is impossible, Khulud said. Look at the prices. A pack of diapers costs $50, 100 grams of baby milk, $3, a pack of oats or wheat seeds, $7, a jar of honey around $50, the list goes on and on. She added, Given these prices, it would cost us around $200 a week to take care of him. That's way more than we can afford. Mahmoud has fled Gaza City's beach refugee camp for Deir al-Balah in the middle area. His 4-year-old son has started urinating in his sleep. Bedwetting is a known symptom of childhood trauma. The boy's life is truly miserable, Mahmoud, who has 7 other children, said. He added, he is at the age where he should no longer be wearing diapers, but he must do so at nighttime now. Mahmoud is a fisher. It is too dangerous for him to ply his trade. Even before the current war, the Zionist regime was frequently attacking fishers. Mahmoud said, I have lost everything in this war. My home, my work, I have nothing left. It causes great pain to go back to my tent every single day and see this child crying for milk and bread. Mahmoud has left Al Rimal, a neighborhood in Gaza City, for Deir al-Balah. His wife is pregnant. Mahmoud said, I am extremely concerned about her and my next son. We are praying every single day that this war ends. I've lost my work, and we do not know what has happened to our home. I'm just baffled and bewildered. Ola Nasser has been devastated by the genocidal war on Gaza. Her husband and her son were killed when the Zionist regime attacked their neighbor's home in the southern city of Khan Yunis. She recalls that a very heavy and large missile fell on their house during the attack. Nasser was upstairs with her daughter, while her husband and son were down the stairs. She said, suddenly I found myself on the street. I was on a pile of rubble. When she was brought to hospital, Nasser learned that her husband and son had been killed. My heart is still aches for the loss of everything, she said. My husband, my child, and the school where I worked. Nasser is a science teacher. Before the war, she was working in the Shajaya neighborhood of Gaza City. The area where my school was located is completely destroyed, Nasser said. Like so many others, she had hoped that the Zionist regime would spare schools which have become shelters for displaced people. Nasser said, schools and hospitals are supposed to be safe places in the war. Almost 400 schools in Gaza have been damaged or destroyed during the current war. These schools previously served approximately 460,000 children and 17,000 teachers. According to United Nations estimates, at least 55% of schools will require either major repairs or complete reconstruction. Samia Salem taught math in Tel al-Hawa area of Gaza City before the war. She laments how Israeli regime troops laid siege to the area. Schools and other civilian infrastructures were shelled. She said, there will be no schooling for children this year. Then we will need a long period to restore everything. That means students could lose another year, and this will greatly affect their motivation and the level of their education. Salem fled Gaza City for Rafah in the south 2 months ago. With classes unable to function as normal, she had observed how children and parents are still trying to learn in a more informal setting. Many children in Gaza are reading and learning math in tents. Education has been repeatedly disrupted in Gaza over recent years, both because of Israel's attacks and the COVID-19 pandemic. Salem said, we need to protect the schools. They must not be exposed to bombing and destruction. Every aspect of education has been affected. Kindergartens have even been attacked by the Zionist regime. Sadiq al-Khuzur, spokesperson for the education ministry in Gaza, said, Israel does not consider that Palestinians have a right to education. Israel has destroyed our schools and disrupted the process of scientific and intellectual development. Zoha Al-Daba is a 12-year-old girl from Al-Zaytun, east of Gaza City. Her family had to evacuate their home and head for Khan Yunis. She said, The occupation destroyed my school. Why is Israel attacking education? Zoha does not know how many children from her school have been martyred in this war, she said. I miss books and school activities. I used to spend a long time in school. Now we spend all our time in a tent. I want my old routine back.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
Last September, the 22nd Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit successfully concluded in the Uzbek city of Samarkand with the formal inclusion of Iran as a permanent member of the organization. A major step for Tehran, the membership was, however, belittled by critics as a move of merely symbolic significance that would bring no benefits in the country's economic sectors, given the security-based nature of the organization on the one hand and a bevy of sanctions on the Islamic Republic of Iran on the other hand. Now, a few months into Iran's official membership in the SCO, has the country had any improvement in its economy? Or, as predicted by some political pundits, was it useless for Tehran in pragmatic terms? Has the country been better positioned to neutralize sanctions without making concessions to the imposers of those sanctions? Or is it disappointed by the organization still scrambling to find new ways so as to cushion the blow of cruel sanctions? Meanwhile, what are Tehran's obstacles to benefit fully from its SCO membership? These and more on this edition of Iran Today. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization was originally formed by Beijing and Moscow as a counterweight to the United States' influence. The SCO's primary goal is to neutralize common threats to the national security and territorial integrity of member states from separatist and radical movements. But to rule out the possibility of any economic benefits is just jumping to conclusions. Although the Shanghai Cooperation Organization was formed as a result of security concerns, the concept of security itself has expanded over time to cover other areas not traditionally considered as security-related ones. Today, security is not merely a military or intelligence issue, but it incorporates a wide range of issues from cybersecurity to trade security.
Our countries share approaches on the most pressing issues on the international agenda and come out with a coordinated position in the UN and regional organizations. Together, we have managed to achieve tangible results in the development and interaction in the economy, trade, industry, science and high technology, environmental protection, cultural humanitarian areas, and many others.
Although the SCO is not currently like NATO or the European Union, where members enjoy certain privileges such as mutual defense or economic integration, Iran's membership means that the country has a wider geographic reach where it can engage with Russia, China, India, and Pakistan, as well as a lot of Central Asian states. Mr. Mohammad Reza Sabzalipour, head of Tehran World Trade Center, had more to say about the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. What is the significance of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization?
Sazman Shanghai بسیار سازمان مهمی است.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization is a very important body. The SCO is not a household name, but it doesn't mean that it's not an important or a powerful organization. It has a potential to play even a more critical role in the international arena. As for Iran, the country's membership in the SCO has had its own positive impact on its activities in the world. It's an undeniable fact. Regardless of Iran's own status in the world as an individual country, there is no doubt that its membership in the SCO can further improve its place in the world.
The organization's potential for economic connectivity can nullify Washington's sustained efforts to isolate Iran economically. After all, comprising 40% of the world's population and 30% of global GDP, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization is the largest regional organization in the world. The organization's commitment to promoting mutual trust, cooperation, and collaboration is evident in the flourishing trade relationships between its members. Mr. Farzin Aghabozorgi, an Iranian financial expert, told us that Iran's membership in the SCO can be a textbook example for other countries.
How do you assess Iran's policy of a pivot to the East? Do you think it can be a game changer for Iran in the face of a hostile Western sanctions?
It's an international lesson for other countries. If you cannot be on good terms with the West, pivot to, for example, the East. You might achieve your goals. What the Islamic Republic has done can be regarded as an international experience. In this regard, Iran can serve as a role model for those countries who might not get along well with the West in the future, for whatever the reason. Instead, they can count on the East as a reliable alternative. Willy-nilly, the East has risen as an economic giant, and joining an organization such as the Shanghai Cooperation Organization that has members such as China, Russia, and India is a calculated move that can pay off both politically and economically.
Iran's full membership in the SCO is now opening up a new horizon of multilateralism. It dovetails with the country's policy pivot to the East, which seeks, among other things, strategic allies against the hegemony of the West and solutions to the country's banking and trade issues caused chiefly by U.S. sanctions.
In the words of the Iranian President Sayed Ibrahim Raisi, "One of our priorities today in foreign policy is preferring the East to the West, neighbors to remote countries."
How is Iran's membership in the SCO of significance, especially in terms of economic aspects?
از بابت جمعیتی که حضور دارند در این کشورهای عضو.
The SCO member states make up for over 3.5 billion out of almost 8 billion people of the world. In other words, about half of the world's total population. This is not something to ignore. This is a big market for any country in the world. When you join an organization, you are in fact removing the borders with its member states, a great capacity for exports. In the country, we have a market of almost 85 million people. But when you join an organization such as the SCO, you have access to a market that has nearly 4 billion people, or simply put, half of the world. This is a very important point. The member states are also big in terms of geography. China, Russia, India, Pakistan, and Iran are vast countries. In terms of military power, these countries are among the world's top powers. These factors give great importance to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. As a member, Iran can benefit from such a great organization.
According to the latest figures released by Iran's Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade, the country has exchanged some 64.3 million tons of non-oil products valued at $37.1 billion with the SCO member states in the first 10 months of the current Iranian year, that is between March 21, 2023 and January 20, 2024. In other words, Iran's 10-month trade with the members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization has increased by 41% in terms of weight and 5.5% in value compared to figures reported in last year's corresponding period. Iran's exports to the bloc accounted for 48.2% of the weight and 44.4% of the value of the country's total exports in the said 10 months. China, India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Russia were the top five destinations for Iranian export products in the mentioned period, followed by Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Belarus, and Mongolia. Meanwhile, we met with Dr. Mehdi Bostanchi, CEO of an industrial group active in designing and manufacturing ventilation systems. The group is half a century old and has both domestic and international customers.
Our group is a knowledge-based company that manufactures special ventilators and fans for big industries. We have an active DNR department, which has helped us manufacture high-tech and marketable products.
Dr. Bostanchi said that Iran's membership in organizations such as the SCO can facilitate the exporting process.
Look, joining international organizations can boost our exports to the international markets. As you know, Iran is faced with unfair sanctions by the United States, and the country is experiencing an economic war, so to speak. Under such circumstances, joining an organization like the SCO, which seeks to confront the hegemony of the U.S., can ease the conditions for us.
At the same time, Iran's imports from the SCO reached 9.7 million tons, worth over $19 billion, accounting for 29.7% in weight and 35.2% in value of the country's total imports in the same period. This dynamic exchange of goods highlights the deepening economic ties between Iran and the SCO member states. To what extent do you think Iran can rely on the SCO as an organization that would help the country to prosper more or circumvent unilateral U.S. sanctions imposed on Iran?
When we are talking about sanctions imposed on Iran, we are talking about a regime of sanctions designed to restrict our access to markets belonging to the U.S. allies or to the EU's allies. We, on the other hand, have joined an organization that doesn't recognize such sanctions in the first place. For example, similar sanctions have been imposed on Russia, and Moscow doesn't recognize such sanctions. As for China, the country also doesn't recognize such sanctions, and despite great pressure from the United States, China has kept its commercial ties with Tehran, and the U.S. hasn't dared to punish China for ignoring the sanctions, because it might have negative repercussions for Washington itself. We've joined an organization that intends to confront the U.S. and its hegemony, which manifests itself partly in the form of sanctions. This is a great opportunity for Iran.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
China and Russia, as two major members of the SCO, have established wide-ranging and strong relationship with Iran over the past few decades in areas such as energy, defense cooperation, and geostrategic balancing with the United States.
This organization and the membership of Iran can provide a very good access to more cooperation. So Iran can provide all abilities such as energy and other assets which we have to share with the members.
Iran's accession to the SCO has geoeconomic importance as well. It can help Iran become a hub country by playing a central role in the east-west and north-south transit corridors. How can Iran be an indispensable member for the SCO?
There is no doubt that the region is a major energy hub in the world. In this regard, Iran, with its rich natural resources, can be an interesting option for many countries. For the same reason, Iran can play a crucial role in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. With more investment in the country's oil and energy sectors, Iran can even overtake countries such as Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, and Saudi Arabia in terms of oil exports.
Tehran has assured the SCO members to provide safe, stable, and reliable routes on the North-South corridor and at the same time supply remarkable infrastructure in its southern port, especially the oceanic port of Chabahar. In 2021, Iran's trade with the SCO member states exceeded $37 billion U.S. dollars, which accounts for about 30% of the country's total foreign trade. This is Abbas Argon of Tehran Chamber of Commerce. What are some of Iran's major export destinations?
Currently, China is the top importer of our products. It's followed by countries such as the UAE, Iraq, Turkey, and India. Our major exports are petrochemical products, which account for nearly 40% of our total exports. Nearly 35% of our exports refer to metal and steel products, followed by agricultural products, ceramic tiles, carpets, and other non-oil products.
As the world watches the unfolding story of Iran's deepening relationship with the SCO, it is clear that it is a tale of ambition, collaboration, and the transformative power of trade. With the lines between these nations continuing to blur, the future of the region's economic landscape looks brighter than ever. To what extent do you think that Iran becoming a member of organizations such as the SCO or ECHO, that is the Economic Cooperation Organization, can help the country in exports?
As for regional and international agreements, I should say that they are definitely to the benefit of the country. If you want to increase your exports, you need to develop your economic ties. You need to have a dynamic diplomacy in the fields of trade and commerce. The more we develop our ties with our neighbors, the more we develop our ties in the region and beyond, the more we can export our products. At the same time, we need to diversify our products to have a deeper reach in the markets.
Iran's membership in the SCO is also in tandem with the Chinese policy of Asian people to uphold Asian security. Given its political clout in the region, Iran can play a central role in dealing with security concerns for the SCO members.
I've heard of an expression saying that there is a long queue outside the door of the SCO. And I think this metaphor is not exaggerated. Indeed, many countries out there are showing strong interest in joining the SCO. Why is this happening? I think given the profound global changes that we are witnessing, members of the international community are expecting a new type of international relations based on mutual respect, equity, and justice and mutual benefit. They recognize that the essence of the SCO Charter and Shanghai spirit reflect this new type of international relations.
The Shanghai Cooperation Organization works to strengthen security and trade cooperation in Eurasia.
I think international interactions can help us develop our exports. Regarding the SCO, it's a big market, a reliable market with great trade partners. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization, like the BRICS, is a good conduit for accessing a big, thriving market. It can help us increase the value and volume of our exports. Organizations such as the SCO can help us out, especially now that we are dealing with sanctions.
Iran's membership in the group would demonstrate the country's good relations with China, Russia, and Central Asia at a time that the West is hell-bent on rendering Iran an isolated country. For example, last August, Tehran and Moscow announced they would start using their own currencies for trade rather than the dollar. Iran and Uzbekistan also signed several cooperation agreements ahead of the SCO summit. And back in June, Iran and Kazakhstan unveiled a new railway network in a further effort to boost trade.
Establishing a system for regional settlements using one or two currencies for trade settlement, or even using unified currencies, can undoubtedly reduce the complexity of regional settlements and greatly promote trading. At the same time, such measures would also help ensure regional financial security, strengthen the stability of the financial system, reduce the impact of fluctuations in the global financial market.
For years, the West has been tightening the screw on Tehran to abandon its peaceful nuclear program, among other things. But with the country's membership in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the West seems toothless in threatening Iran. Iran can now cooperate more intensely with China, Russia, and the rest of the SCO members, such as India and Pakistan, to build immunity against Western sanctions and pressures, a game changer to the chagrin of the West. That's all for today. Thank you from the whole team. Please do join us again, same times next week and each week after. Till next time, take care.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and welcome to our latest episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Last week, we completed explanation of Surah Jin, and today we take up the next surah, that is Surah Muzammil, the number 73 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It was revealed in Mecca and has 20 ayahs. The surah revealed in the early days of the Prophet's universal mission of Islam opens by addressing him as Muzammil, or the enwrapped in a cloak or sheet. This epithet means the one renouncing the vanities of the world, or separating himself from all trifle matters for the purpose of meditation. which indicates the prophet's preparedness to receive the divine commandments to guide mankind. The surah describes how God relaxed the early regime of devotion first decreed to the prophet and prepared him for the weighty message of divine revelation. The prophet is urged to be patient against the enemies and is informed in Ayah 10 of the punishment that awaits the disbelievers in hell. Ayah 15 refers to the punishment that befell Egyptian tyrant, the Pharaoh, while alive, thereby drowning him in the sea. According to a hadith from the Prophet, whoever regularly recites Surah Muzzammil will not face hardships in this world and in the hereafter. We invite you to listen to Ayahs 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم يا أيها المزمل قم الليل إلا قليلا نصفه أو انقص منه قليلا أو زد عليه ورتل القرآن ترتيلا إنا سنلقي عليك قولا ثقيلا.
In the name of Allah, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. O you wrapped up in your mantle, rise to observe vigil through the night, except a little, a half, or reduce a little from that, or add to it, and recite the Quran in a measured tone. Indeed, soon we shall bestow on you a weighty word. The Almighty Creator affectionately addresses His best of creation with words which mean, O you who are wrapped in your mantle, that is, O you who is girded to undertake that which has been entrusted to you, so rise up at night for prayer, especially the post-midnight prayer, and for contemplation at a time when people are normally asleep after the daily routines. Tahajjud, or the post-midnight prayer, is not compulsory but highly recommended. The Prophet, his successors, the infallible Imams, and the members of his progeny, the Ahlul Bayt, as well as the devout believers, never missed it. The All-Merciful Lord, however, does not want the Prophet and the true believers to forego sleep the whole night, as is clear by the use of the word qum, or rise from sleep, as well as the words regarding the night such as nisf, or half of it, and qalil, or a little part of it, and zid, or increase in its duration. All this indicates that no burden is imposed upon the ardent worshippers who could decrease or increase their nighttime prayers and contemplation, depending upon their spirit of enthusiasm and physical strength, in the quietude and tranquility of midnight. The All-Wise God urges the recitation of the ayahs of the Noble Qur'an with emphasis on the word tartil, that is, its mediative recitation, in a well-ordered manner or a measured tone, since contemplation on the divine message is the best means of strengthening faith, spiritual growth, steadfastness, and proper cognizance of the Almighty Creator. Ayah 5 speaks of bestowing the Prophet with a weighty word, which seemingly implies the timeless wisdom of the final heavenly scripture to all mankind, that is, the Noble Quran. It also reflects the fact that the responsibility to guide mankind is such a weighty and momentous task that the Prophet requires an astute assistant in accomplishing his mission. This is clear by the request of Prophet Moses to God for designating Aaron as his deputy, and the divine commandment to the Prophet of Islam to proclaim as vicegerent his worthy cousin Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him. These ayahs teach us that, number one, Islam views the tranquility of the night as the best time to supplicate and meditate rather than sleeping all through it or wasting it on pleasures. Number two, the late midnight prayer and contemplation in the quietude of night strengthens the spiritual ability for better performance of daytime duties. And number three, recitation of the Quran with proper pondering on its message enlightens the mind and uplifts the heart. Let us listen to ayahs 6 and 7 of the same surah.
Inna nashi'ata al-layli hiya ashaddu wat'an wa aqwa muqila. Inna laka fin-nahari sabhan tawila.
Indeed, the watch of the night is firmer in tread and more upright in respect to speech. For indeed, during the day, you have drawn out engagements. The merits of late night worship, including contemplation, in an atmosphere of tranquility, when calm and silence prevails everywhere, free of the distracting duties of the day, is the most suitable time for purifying the mind and firming up the soul through reflection on realities and gaining the proper cognizance of God Almighty and the wisdom of his commandments. Moreover, waking up at night for prayer is not easy, since it is a sort of a struggle against oneself. Hence, it makes a person strong in overcoming physical desires. Elsewhere, in Ayah 17 of Surah Sajde, the Noble Quran mentions the reward of those who wake up for the post-midnight prayer, saying, "No one knows what has been kept hidden for them of comfort as a reward for what they used to do." The next ayah tells the Prophet, and through him the believers, that daytime is for attending to and discharging duties. For the Prophet, it is guiding the people, elucidating the divine message, and providing solutions for the various issues of the society and matters pertaining to the individuals. For us, the ordinary believers, daytime is fulfillment of our duties as a citizen or a member of the community, or a wage earner for the family. Of course, while discharging all these duties, we should realize we are in the presence of Allah the Omnipresent and carry out these tasks in the best possible manner. These ayahs teach us that, number one, the midnight vigil is very effective in self-building. Number two, the success in daytime affairs requires a strong relation with God at all times, especially the nightly hours. And number three, it is the power of prayers and reflection on the flawless eloquence and timeless wisdom of the Noble Quran that provides us the clarity of vision to properly carry our daytime duties. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here are ayahs 8 and 9 of Surah Muzammil.
وَاذْكُرْ اسْمَ رَبِّكَ وَتَبَتَّلْ إِلَيْهِ تَبْتِيلًا رَبُّ الْمَشْرِقِ وَالْمَغْرِبِ لَا إِلَهَ إِلَّا هُوَ فَاتَّخِذْهُ وَكِيلًا
So celebrate the name of your Lord and dedicate yourself to Him with total dedication. Lord of the East and the West, there is no God except Him, so take Him for your trustee. What is intended here is not just the remembrance and glorifying of the lofty name and attributes of the Almighty Creator, but proper attention in order to purify the soul and foster the spirit of total dedication to His decrees. In other words, it means God-weariness within the framework of a life devoted to the family and the society in view of the physical faculties He has bestowed. This means the one and only God does not want true believers to turn away from lawful amenities of life as practiced by certain self-styled ascetics who shun the bounties of the world by calling themselves Sufis or the Christian monks, and the sadhus of Hinduism and Buddhism who do not marry and feign celibacy while secretly indulging in sins and carnal pleasures of the flesh besides hoarding wealth and abusing powers. The next ayah says the Almighty Creator of the universe is absolute Lord of all places, beings, things, and the natural phenomena. Therefore, believers should not be discouraged by the plots or hostility of the wicked and evil persons. There is no God beside Him, neither any deity to symbolize Him, nor any idol to identify Him. He alone deserves to be worshipped and relied upon. From these ayahs, we learn that, number one, expression of the lofty name and attributes of the Almighty Creator should be from the depth of the heart and with firm conviction so as to detach ourselves from pointless distractions, vanity, and trivial matters. And number two, we should solely rely upon God and worship Him alone rather than trusting mortals, however powerful, and committing the cardinal sin of disbelief and idol worship, since He, omnipresent, is Creator and Master of the entire universe.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is the part of the speech delivered by the Commander-in-Chief of Iran's Armed Forces, Imam Khamenei. Martyr Soleimani revived the resistance front and its strengthening must continue. December 31st, 2023. In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. We are grateful to God for gifting this worldly reward to this outstanding figure, Martyr Soleimani, every day before our eyes. What you are witnessing, the spreading and propagation of his name and memory, is this honorable man's worldly reward. We cannot even imagine or fathom what kind of reward he will receive in the hereafter. This is just his worldly reward. I imagine that from the day he was martyred and continuing up until today, Martyr Soleimani's name, his memory, and his characteristics have spread among the people many times more than during his lifetime. This is the same thing that someone once said, Martyr Soleimani is more dangerous for us than Qasim Soleimani. The other side had said this. They were right. That truly is the case. So, not only has the dust of forgetfulness not settled on this martyr, his splendor, brightness, and lucidity have increased every day, and God willing, this will continue to increase even more. This is God's grace. Why did this happen? I believe it is because of Martyr Soleimani's sincerity. This is the same thing that is often difficult for people.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
We do things, but the spirit of the work that we do lies in sincerity. The work that was undertaken by this martyr truly had this kind of spirit in it. He truly worked with sincerity. We would sense this when we communicated with him about his work. There was no showing off, pretentiousness, or egoism in his work. He worked for the cause of God. His actions were for the cause of God. I believe it was his sincerity that made his worldly reward so apparent. We observed such a thing in Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh, as well. He was the same. 3 or 4 days after Imam Khomeini had been buried, a large meeting was held in his shrine. The shrine was barely anything at that time. They had just enclosed it with a fence. We went there. I went with a helicopter. As I stared down at the desert there, that section has been built now, but it was mostly a desert back then, I saw the crowd walking there on foot. Who was taking them there? What was it that appealed to them so much that it drew them there? I said it was Imam Khomeini's sincerity that drew those people there. And it was the same with our dear martyr. He was a sincere man.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Gaza is on the brink of famine. The head of the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, warned in late February. Yazan Al-Kafarna, a 10-year-old with cerebral palsy, died in An-Najjar Hospital in Rafah after suffering from malnutrition. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, a child in Gaza identified as Yazan Al-Kafarna is one of the latest to die of hunger and malnutrition in the besieged enclave since the start of the war on October 7th. According to local media reports, Kafarna died in An-Najjar Hospital in Rafah recently, bringing the total number of children who have died from malnutrition since October to 16. Images and videos shared of Kafarna from March 2nd show him lying on a hospital bed with sunken cheeks. In one video, his father shows a photo of his son before the war looking healthy. He said, before the war he was healthy. He had access to all the food and medical care he needed. When the war started, everything was cut off. This happened to him from the lack of nutrition and him not having important foods. Adding that the photo of him was taken just a week before the war started. Kafarna's family were displaced from Beit Hanun in Gaza to Rafah in the south. Family members told Al Jazeera Arabic in an interview that Kafarna reached a stage where he was surviving on just a few morsels of bread. One family member, Muhammad Al Kafarna, said, he was living on scraps of bread we found with great difficulty and brought at extremely high cost. If we couldn't find food, we would give him sugar just so he could stay alive. The main reason he has reached the point where he just looks like bones is a lack of nutrition. According to Kafarna, Yazan reached a point where he needed specific food and nutrients to keep him alive after losing so much of his body weight. However, the family could not get hold of anything they required. Yazan had suffered from cerebral palsy from birth, meaning he had to follow a special diet and take supplements. However, his family said that since the start of the war, he has not had access to any of these things. Journalists in Gaza have documented the death of other children as a result of malnutrition and hunger. Hossam Shabbat, a journalist in Gaza, said that a young girl died after not having access to milk, while another, identified as Heba Ziadeh, died in the Kamal Adwan Hospital in northern Gaza from dehydration and malnutrition. Last week, the spokesperson for Ministry of Health in Gaza, Ashraf Al-Ghudra, said that the Israeli occupation is waging a new war on the residents of Gaza, a war of starvation, adding that the number of people dying of hunger and malnutrition was increasing, especially children.
He explained that the health system in northern Gaza is now completely unable to meet the needs of the besieged territory, particularly after the Kamal Adwan Hospital was captured by the Zionist regime forces. Gaza is on the brink of famine, the head of the United Nations Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, warned in late February. Philippe Lazzarini wrote on social media,